for the invitation for this visit. I really enjoyed this visit. I like the atmosphere here as well as the food, the cafeteria. Today I will be presenting to you our understanding of the multi-insulating behavior and the superconductivity in twisted belly graphene. The work is done in collaboration with Adrian Paul, Ashwin Vishwanath, and my advisor center. The references are here. Without further ado, let me give you my outline. I will first give some introduction to some very basic background. Then I will review the experiments on twisted belly graphene. And next, I will present our understanding of the experimental phenomena. Then I will propose an effective model to study the system. Finally, I will summarize. Let me start by introducing the concept of Moree pattern. A Moree pattern is an interference pattern that is obtained by having two layers of lattices that are almost identical but a little bit different. Their difference can either be in the shape of the lattices or be the orientation of the lattices. For example, suppose we have two identical honeycomb lattices at the beginning. We put them on top of each other and rotate one of them with respect to the other. We will get different Moree patterns. And you can see some emergent triangular super lattice whose unit cell is much larger than the original honeycomb lattice. As you can probably figure out, if I rotate the system by some arbitrary angle, the resulting system will not have exact translation symmetry. Only when the twist angle is of some special values, the resulting system will have exact translation symmetry, and those twist angles are called convergent twist angles. Other twist angles are called inconvergent twist angles. Now here's a small quiz for you. Among the four Moree patterns, which ones do you think are from convergent twist angles and which ones are from inconvergent twist angles? Number four is from what? Convergent? Any other guess?
Well, mathematically speaking, all of them are commensurate in the end, right? Any real numbers arbitrary, so it's still a measurement.
I mean, exact. Okay, let me tell you the answer. Actually, the first three are from convergent twist angles, and this one is from inconvergent twist angle. I think this one is clearly is a very nice crystal. You will guess it's from a convergent twist angle. But the second and the third is not that obvious. To help you visualize it, let me circle out the emergent superunit cell of the second and third one. They are indeed from convergent twist angles. And moreover, so these three have exact translation symmetries. Not only do they have exact translation symmetries, they in fact have the same translation symmetries, meaning the translation lattice vectors are the same for these three. The last one is from an inconvergent twist angle. But you can still see there's some emergent triangular lattice. The lesson that we learn from here is that even the twist angle is inconvergent, as suggested by Luke, there's still approximate translation symmetry. In particular, when the twist angle becomes smaller and smaller, the approximate translation symmetry becomes better and better. So in the case of a small but arbitrary twist angle, the system can still be viewed as a good crystal, and it still makes sense to talk about the band structure of the resulting system. Okay. This is the introduction for Moree pattern. Now let me briefly introduce the basic physics of a monolayer graphene. A monolayer graphene can be viewed as an electronic system where electrons live on a honeycomb lattice. The band structure roughly looks like this. This is the hexagonal Brillouin zone of the monolayer graphene. On the corners of the Brillouin zone, there are Dirac points at the K and K prime points. These Dirac points are stable in the sense that they are protected by symmetries. I will elaborate on this later. And moreover, one feature in monolayer graphene is that the Dirac cones in this graphene is four-fold degenerate. The four-fold degeneracy comes from two-fold of valley degeneracy and two-fold of spin degeneracy. The two valleys refer to the K and K prime points. And as we know, electrons have two spins, so there's a fourfold degeneracy. One feature that I want to mention now is we know for Dirac fermion, if we circle a closed path around the Dirac point, we get a biphase pi. This tells us there's some winding of the wave function near the Dirac point. Now, for these two Dirac points, they are related by time reversal. We know the winding will be opposite. In our language, we say they have opposite chiralities. I will also elaborate more on this later. This will play an important role. Okay, so much for basic introduction. And now I will start reviewing the experiments on twisted belly graphing. This is a cartoon picture for the experimental samples that the MIT group studied. They have two layers of graphene on top of each other, and one of them is rotated with respect to each other, and there will be some Moray supernatis. The sample is also in contact with some electronic gates, so people could easily tune the chemical potential as well as the out of plane, the perpendicular electric field. As we discussed earlier, when the twist angle is small, such as like 1 degree, it makes sense to talk about the band structure of the resulting system because it can still be viewed as a good crystal. Now let's see how should we understand such a band structure. To understand it, let's start from a simpler limit where we have two layers of graphene perfectly on top of each other, and let's first assume the two layers are decoupled. Then we will have a hexagonal Brillouin zone for each of the two layers. And at the corners, there will be dual cones. They are decoupled. Now, let me rotate the two layers. In real space, this will generate the Moray super lattice. And in momentum space, the Brillouin zones will also be rotated. As you can guess, because the real space unit cell becomes larger, the momentum space Brillouin zone becomes much smaller. And this much smaller Brillouin zone is called the mini Brillouin zone or the Moray Brillouin zone. Its size is controlled by this twist angle. So at this moment, we still assume the two layers are decoupled. That is to say, what happens now is just the Dirac crossings from each layer are separated by amount that's controlled by the twist angle theta. As you can see, when this twist angle is small, the mini Brillouin zone is so small, so the Dirac points contributed from this valley of the macroscopic graphene is very far from the Dirac points contributed from the other valley of the macroscopic graphene. So effectively, we can ignore the coupling between the two valleys and have a valley conservation symmetry of the system. In this way, it makes sense to talk about the band structure of the resulting system for a single valley. Now let's look at this valley. So remember at this moment, they are still decoupled. So we just have two Dirac cones from two layers. And now let's add the interlayer coupling between the two layers. This will modify the band structure. For example, let's look at this point where the momentum and the energy of the two states from the two layers are the same. And then due to level repulsion, one of the two states will be pushed up in energy and the other will be pushed down in energy by the interlayer tunneling. And this tells us the effect of the interlayer tunneling is to make the bands flatter. Then, when the tunneling strength is parameterized by the parameter W is of the order of this energy, the bands can be really flat. And this is roughly the notion of the metric angle where the band becomes very flat qualitatively. More quantitatively, people can calculate the band structure and found this dispersion. People found there are two isolated nearly flat bands for each valley and each spin. That is to say, taking into account both valleys and spins, there will be 8 orbitals in total. And the blue curves are the dispersion for the nearly flat bands. Another feature that I would like to mention is that the charge density of the nearly flat bands are mainly concentrated on the triangular lattice sides of the emergent Moree lattice. So what do we have here? We have a very tunable system where we can control the doping, control the electric field. And such a tunable system is also very flat, which will enhance the interaction effect. This indicates the system will be an excellent platform for studying the physics with strong correlation. Indeed, the MIT group found some interesting physics. Here I'm showing you the transport data for such samples, for one of the samples. This is the conductivity as a function of doping. This zero means the point of charge neutrality. And here you see two big transport gaps. According to previous studies, those gaps correspond to the gaps that separate the isolated bands from above and below. So they are the band structure gaps. Interestingly, in the middle of the Fini factor, that's at some fractional Fini, they also observed some insulating behavior. So those insulators occur at fractional Fini, and they should be viewed as some Morton insulators. More information of the Morton insulators can be revealed by the quantum oscillation data. So near the Morton insulator, in the whole doped set, which will be the focus of the talk, the quantum oscillation frequency is set by the carrier density away from the Morton insulator. This tells us there's some Fermi surface starting from the Morton insulator. And the degeneracy of the Landau level is 2, which is half of what we would expect from the valley and the spin degeneracies. And such quantum oscillation features extend to relatively high temperature scales. Moreover, when the Morton insulator is doped, people observe the superconducting domes around the Morton insulator. And such superconductors can be killed by a magnetic field. Even for in-plane magnetic field, there's a finite critical field strength. This field strength is of the order such that the corresponding Zeeman energy is of the same order as the transition temperature. This indicates the superconductor is a spin singlet superconductor.
Yeah, I have a question about this. Maybe you know, because I've never talked to the experimenters, but I guess you did. On the middle picture, they draw this nice dotted line as if there are two domes. If you kind of think this dotted line away, the really black part doesn't seem to be more like one dome, right?
Because this is the other part.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, but if you just look at the color should indicate the resistivity, right?
Yes.
So it appears that it's also superconducting at a finite temperature if you're exactly at the half filling. Is that true, or I don't know, like that?
That is true.
Okay, so strictly speaking, the dotted line should not really go to zero.
The dotted line is theory, and the color is the evidence, so they don't necessarily have to match.
No, I don't think the dotted line is, I don't think there's a theory behind the dotted line.
No, the dotted line is not a theory. But actually, I missed your question. What do you mean the dotted line shouldn't go to zero?
Okay, let me rephrase the question, perhaps one step back. What is the dotted line? Is that a theory, or is that just a guide to the eye?
It's some guide.
Okay, so then the second question is there superconductivity at non-zero temperatures and half filling?
This is the resistivity is very small at half filling, indeed.
Yeah, so, okay.
That's the phenomena.
Yes, but is it comparable to what they call superconductivity?
It's roughly indeed comparable.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. But still, let's say the phase diagram is such that near the half filling is Morton insulator at low temperatures. Then until maybe at very low temperatures, something else happens. It could be disorder effect. In such Morton insulator, the interaction may not be that strong. It may be of the same order as the bandwidth. Then if you have some charged particles, it may induce some conduction. Okay. By the way, there's another piece of data that I didn't show, that is the insulator can also be eliminated by a magnetic field. And the magnetic field, this magnetic field is known to be independent of the orientation. And the magnitude is also of the same order as this, as the transport gap. The magnitude of the corresponding Zeta energy is of the same order as the transport gap. This also tells us the insulator is also a spin singlet.
So the magnetic the results with magnetic field is for the whole dope or independent doping?
This is for optimal doping.
For what?
Optimal doping.
In the,
so it's here.
Okay.
It's like there.
And for other doping, it's similar?
I think it's similar, but not much data is shown there. Okay. So far I've reviewed the experimental phenomena. Now let me present our understanding of such experiments. So our understanding has a few different sources of inputs. Here we have some inputs from the experiments. First, we did see there's a Mohr insulator at fractional filling. Second, from quantum oscillation, the degeneracy of the host is twofold, which is half of what you would expect from spin and valley degeneracy. So this indicates maybe the spin or valley degeneracy is lifted. But the field dependence of the insulating behavior and the superconducting behavior indicates the pairing is spin singlet. So most likely the spin degeneracy is not eliminated. So a natural guess would be the valley degeneracy is lifted by spontaneous symmetry breaking.
When you say fractional filling, that is with respect to the triangular layer support layer structure?
Right. And there's also some hints from a more detailed looking at the band structure. Here again, I'm showing you the cartoon picture that qualitatively explains the reason of the flat bands. In this row, I'm showing you some serious calculation of the band structure. Those calculations, some of them are based on ab initio type of method studied on some conventional twist angle with a really very large unit cell. And some of them are obtained from effective continuum model that is supposed to work at any small twist angle. One common feature of all these calculations is that there will be the isolated flat bands. This is one common feature. The other common feature from all these different studies is that I'm circling out some Dirac coefficients at the K and K prime point of the Mourey Brillouin zone. So all of them have found some Dirac coefficients at the K and K prime Mourey Brillouin zone for each valley. This is the band structure for a single valley. This will be an important feature of the system because it seems very robust. Different methods on different twist angles all see such a Dirac coefficient. Then it motivates us to find some symmetry-based reason to explain why the Dirac coefficients are so robust. So what symmetries do we need to protect the Dirac coefficient? Because spin will be irrelevant here, let me ignore spin completely. Because we want to talk about the Dirac coefficient of a single valley, so we should the first symmetry we should have is the U1 valley symmetry, the valley conservation symmetry. Otherwise, we wouldn't even be able to talk about the single valley band structure. Okay, now this is some default symmetry. Now after those symmetries by default, what natural symmetries we can consider to protect the Dirac coefficient? It turns out the minimal set of symmetries that we need to use is a six-fold rotational symmetry C6 and a time reversal symmetry. More precisely, let's go back to the Brillouin zone of a single layer graphene. Under a six-fold rotation, one valley is mapped to the other valley. So for a single valley, six-fold rotation is not a symmetry, but six-fold rotation doing it twice is a symmetry. That generates a C3 rotation. A C3 rotation is a symmetry of a single valley. Also, time reversal maps one valley to the other. That's also not a symmetry of a single valley. But we can combine it with C6 three times to make a C2T. This is also a symmetry. C2T is also a symmetry of a single valley. Later, I will explain by combining the C3 symmetry and the C2T, the system will be able to protect the dual crossings.
So here, time reversal doesn't flip spin.
Here, time reversal is the spinless time reversal.
So U1V is not a microscopic symmetry?
It's not. In fact, even translation, rotation, none of them is.
Are you saying that it's the emergence symmetry?
Right.
You're assuming that it's the case with the Moyer structure that continues to
the case? I don't really want to say I assume that, because that should be the case in the real experiments. I know the MIT experimentalists are all amazing, but it's still too much for me to ask them to make some commensurate twist angle. So generically, in the real experiments, the twist angle is incommensurate, and there may be some mismatch of the rotating twisting center. So generically, all those symmetries are just emergent. However, in the limit of a small twist angle, such emergent symmetries becomes better and better when the twist angle becomes smaller and smaller. This is already established a few years ago by other studies. Okay.
Do you know if this spinless time reversal is preserved experimentally? Can there be some like quantum spin holes?
There isn't. You mean anomalous hole?
Just normal quantum spin
holes. There's neither anomalous Hall signature or quantum spin Hall signature. Okay, then we will be happy. We have identified the minimal set of symmetries that is able to protect the dual crossings. We were happy for maybe 1 or 2 days. Then we realized that we have to pay a price. That is, I will discuss in more details about this. That is that the system will have the so-called one-year obstruction. That is, for such a band structure, there will be no well-localized one-year functions if I want to preserve all the symmetries in a natural fashion. This also indicates to localize the electrons, some of the symmetries will be broken. And to be consistent with what we said earlier, that the valley degeneracy is lifted, it's natural to guess the U1 valley symmetry will be broken.
So these symmetries you're saying are sufficient to guarantee dual crossing?
For a single valley, yes.
Necessary.
I mean it's necessary. Sorry, I mean it's necessary.
It's necessary.
With a smaller symmetry, it will not guarantee the dual crossing. That's what I mean.
You know, just one single dual. Single graphene.
Yeah.
You have only time reversal and inversion.
Yes.
That's enough to
have dual. That's enough to have a dual crossing locally. In this case, the dual points can still move, and the two dual points can meet and annihilate each other. To make them not move, to fix their position, you need the C3.
But in that case, you don't need. Very symmetry.
I don't need what?
You don't need value
U1. I don't need value U1. Here I need value U1 because the dual crossings are for the single valley. Without this, I can't even talk about the dual crossing. The dual crossing is the dual crossing for the single valley band structure.
Yeah, the valley is the value of the graphene, not the volume.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Here the value is the value of the microscopic graphene.
Right.
Okay, let's talk about this valley symmetry breaking in more details. Let me first define the order parameter of the valley symmetry breaking. This order parameter is a three-component object. Let me call it I. It's defined in such a way where tau is a Pauli matrix. And the C of K is the annihilation operator at momentum K. It has three subindices coming from the two valleys, two isolated bands for each valley, and the two spins. To lift the valley degeneracy, I can either have the expectation value of Iz be non-zero, or the expectation value of Ix be non-zero. But if the expectation value of Iz is non-zero, that would break time reversal symmetry, because this means there's some imbalance between the two valleys, but the two valleys are related by time reversal. So if this happens in experiments, one should in principle see anomalous Hall transport, which isn't seen there. So we think this valley imbalance is not an option. Instead, this inter-valley coherence, which means the expectation value of Ix is non-zero, could happen. This means that two valleys are mixed, and the U1 valley symmetry is breaking. Then, because of this breaking of U1 valley symmetry, there will be Goldstone mode. Because it's related to the valley symmetry, we can call it a Vano. We didn't call it in the paper. It's just a cute name. And the electron-Vano interaction will promote superconductivity. This is the picture. So far, I just gave you the motivation and the definition of the inter-valley coherent state which breaks the U1 valley symmetry. But it's better to do a better job. I need to give you a reason why in such a system, the inter-valley coherent state may have a lower energy compared to other states. The reason is basically we found one mechanism. This mechanism is basically very similar to the classic Stoner type argument. Here we have a very flat band where the density of states is large, and with Coulomb interaction, there may be Stoner type instability. To consider the more details, let's look at the Hamiltonian of the system. So we have a kinetic energy for the electrons. Here C is the same electronic operator as before. Epsilon An of K is the dispersion of an electron from valley A. A is the valley index and band N. The dispersions from two valleys are very different. But so this dispersion distinguishes the two valleys, but it doesn't distinguish the two spins, so there's no spin index. And for simplicity, let's also take a very simplified form of interaction. That's a density-density interaction that doesn't distinguish either spin or valley. Then based on this Hamiltonian, let's try to understand why the U1 valley symmetry breaking state should have a lower energy compared to a spin ordered state or valley imbalanced state. To understand this, notice the order parameter for spin ordered state, spin, and the valley imbalanced state, Iz, those two operators are all conserved quantities of the system. So when they acquire some expectation value, it will split the Fermi surface, and then the system can gain energy by going to the Fermi surface that has the lower energy. This is the Stoner argument. The same also happens if Ix, the order parameter of U1v, acquires some expectation value. The Fermi surface will also be split, and the system can gain energy by going to the Fermi surface with the lower energy. But the difference between those cases is Ix is not a conserved quantity. So due to some second order quantum effects, the system can gain further energy compared to this case. And more details can be found in the paper. Okay, so far I have motivated and defined the U1 valley symmetry breaking state. And I also gave a reason for us to believe it may have a lower energy compared to other states. Then we need to ask, after this U1 valley symmetry breaking, whether the system is already in some integer failing factor such that at the Hartree fork level, the system can become a band insulator. The answer turns out to be no. It turns out if we just break the U1 valley symmetry, the experimentally relevant filling factor, the system still cannot be an insulator. More precisely, let's look at the band structure. Suppose this is the band structure with all the symmetry preserved. The red curve is the band structure for one valley, the blue curve is for the other valley. Now, if only the U1 valley symmetry is broken, they will split in such a pattern where there's still leftover dual crossings here. The experimental filling factor is precisely here. So if only the U1 valley symmetry is broken, at hydrophobic level, the system will not be an insulator. To have an insulator, one moment, some further effects need to happen. Those further effects can either be C3 symmetry breaking or translation symmetry breaking. And more exotically, the system could be in some frictionless Morton insulator that breaks no symmetry and has no topological order. And the system can also, in principle, be in some quantum spin liquid state. Yes?
Would the intervalley coherence also predict an insulating state at charge neutrality? Because it appears so from your literature.
Yes.
And that's not seen, right?
It's not seen in experiments. So so we think the intervalley coherence only happens in near that Morton insulator, not in the neutrality. Also, in the neutrality, the quantum oscillation data is also incompatible with the intervalley coherence. So we think the intervalley coherence stops somewhere. Okay, so we need some further effects to get an insulator. What further effect? To know such a further effect, we need to really have a model to study the system. So far, I haven't presented a real model. So we need a model. This invites me to the next section. But before going into the next section, let me review what I have done. I have reviewed the experiments on twisted bibliographing where people saw insulating behavior at fractional filling, and doping the insulators, you get some superconductors. And there's some pattern of the quantum oscillation that motivated us to propose in such a system, the valley symmetry is broken. But we also know just breaking the valley symmetry will be insufficient to have an insulator. There must be some further effects. To understand everything, we need a model. That's the topic for the next section. Any question?
So the valley symmetry is broken in the x direction. You said you call it a Goldstone model, but it is not really gapless because it's not exact symmetry.
So the Goldstone.
So what determines the size of the gap?
First of all, this U1 valley symmetry is not really an exact symmetry. So the amount of the explicit symmetry breaking would determine the size of the gap.
So if gap didn't open, it become better and better as you go to lower energy.
If the gap didn't open?
Yeah. If the valley symmetry is not broken.
Yes.
The gap is, if it is gapless, the low energy limit become really emergent symmetry. Opens a gap with some finite energy scale.
Mm-hmm. I guess you are asking what really happens if we go to lower and lower energy such that we can really resolve the explicit breaking of the U1 valley symmetry. Is this your question?
My question is the size of the gap.
Yeah.
For the pseudo
Goldstone.
Should it be functional both the explicit symmetry breaking term in your Hamiltonian and also the size of the gap? Size of the
symmetry breaking gap, you mean?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Size of the condensate.
Yeah, the size of the condensate.
You know how?
I don't have an expression, but I think it will be proportional to the square of the condensate magnitude plus some explicit gap. Yeah, so it's the summation of them, I think. At the moment, I don't have an explicit expression. But maybe for your information, the size of the explicit symmetry breaking of the U1 valley symmetry is also calculated by DFT people. It's found to be order of mu ev, very small.
microelectron volt.
Yes, mu EV. Yeah. Yeah, now let's go to the part of the model. The question that we pose is, now we have a band structure, we want to understand the interaction effect. This is basically a standard question in the physics of a strongly correlated system. And there's also the standard strategy. The strategy is to first obtain a tight banding model that can describe the band structure. Then we add interactions to the model. Then we solve it. This sounds very simple, but it's very hard to solve. We all know this part is really hard. At the beginning, we thought not until here we wouldn't encounter some hardship. But we actually found even this step is already quite subtle. Let me explain. So the step of obtaining a tight banding model to describe the band structure, we need some rules of game. What are the rules of the game? We want the tight banding model to be able to reproduce the signed features of the band structure. Which features? Those features include, first of all, there should be 8 orbitals per unit cell, including both values and the spins, because that's the experimental setup. Then we should have the symmetry protected Dirac cosines for each valley. And third, there's something more subtle that I will discuss later. Now, recall, the charge density. Maybe let me just hold it.
Yeah.
I can hold it, it's fine. Recall the charge density of the nearly flat bands are mainly concentrated on the triangular lattice sides of the Maurice superlattice. So a natural guess of a tight banding model would be based on a triangular lattice.
Click. There's a clip on it. Or just his pockets.
Maybe in my pocket. Sorry for that. We just said a natural guess of the tight banding model would be based on a triangular lattice. However, a triangular lattice description doesn't work. I will explain it here. And to explain that, let me first explain how C3 and C2T are able to protect a Dirac point, as I promised a while back. So the reason is also simple. Suppose first we tune the parameters of the Hamiltonian to have a Dirac degeneracy. Then when we look at the two degenerate states, look at how they transform under the C3 symmetry, we will see one of them has angular momentum 1 under C3. But C2T flips the angular momentum. This implies there must be another state with angular momentum minus 1 that has the same energy. So as long as we keep C3 and C2T, the degeneracy will be stable. In this sense, the Dirac point is symmetry protected, unless some other bands from above or below touch the Dirac point, which doesn't happen in this system. This is the reason for why C3 and C2T can protect the Dirac points. Another feature we notice in the band structure is for the single valley band structure, at the gamma point, there's no Dirac cosine. This is a simple fact. But when we combine this fact and the Dirac cosines at k and k prime, we will be able to rule out a description based on triangular lattice. To see why, let's first assume a description based on triangular lattice would work. That is, we will have a tight banding model on a triangular lattice to have 8 electrons, 8 orbitals in total for both valleys and spins, we have to have 2 orbitals per site, per valley, per spin. Let's call the annihilation operators of those 2 orbitals, C1 and C2 at the site. Then we can do a Fourier transformation to go to momentum space, get the annihilation operator of electrons at momentum k. Now let's ask about the symmetry properties. Suppose the real space orbitals transform under C3 with angular momentum LZ. When we plug this into the Fourier transformation, we can obtain the symmetry transformation rule of the momentum space operator. And the result is simply this. This result is telling us for C3 invariant momenta in the Brillouin zone, the electron transforms with the same angular momentum as the real space angular momentum. Now in this hexagonal Brillouin zone, both k and k prime and also the gamma points are all C3 invariant. This tells us they should all have the same angular momentum on the C3. This then leads to a contradiction, because then when I combine with C2t, as long as I have dual coercions at k and k prime, I will also have dual coercion at gamma. But at gamma, there's no dual coercion. This contradiction tells us a description based on triangular lattice will not work to capture the structure of this band structure. Okay, before going on, let me review what I just did. I used the constraints of the symmetry representations at high symmetry points to rule out a description based on triangular lattice, and the argument is very simple.
So here C1 and C2 are supposed to capture electron near one valley.
Right.
Only one valley.
Right. Because for a single valley, the band structure has the structure where there are dual coercion at k and k prime, but no dual coercion at gamma.
Can you make it work if you introduce another pair to make
it? That's another system. That's a different system. I can make it work, but it's a different system.
In reality, you have 2 pairs of
right.
K and K prime.
Right. Then in such a description, some feature is lost. Because in reality, the U1 value symmetry will be a good symmetry until below some very low energy scale. Then I should be able to talk about the U1 value single valley band structure. And then in the single valley band structure, I do have dual coercions at k and k prime, but not at gamma. This is a feature that I want to reproduce. Okay, then now we can ask, what kind of lattice is compatible with the representations of this set of representations at high symmetry points? You actually all know the answer, because this set of representations is precisely the same as the set of representations in monolayer graphing, the ordinary graphing. So we should realize a honeycomb lattice should work. In fact, in an earlier paper by my collaborators, Adrian Paul and Ashwin Vishwanath, they studied all the possible space groups in any in 2 and 3 dimensions. They found to satisfy such a condition, only a honeycomb lattice will work. Okay, then let's look at the honeycomb lattice. The honeycomb lattice is pictured with the solid lines, and the dashed lines are the centers of the honeycomb lattice, which is precisely the triangular lattice. But recall, I said earlier, the wave function of the nearly flat bands is such that the charge density are mostly concentrated on the triangular sides. But now if the orbitals are on the honeycomb sides, what does the wave function look like? Here, this honeycomb set is here. So the wave function looks like this shape. It looks like a clover. We could also create a fringed spinner shaped wave function. A fringed spinner is a toy that's popular nowadays. If we look at the honeycomb set, this honeycomb set is here. The fringed spinner wave function is shown here. The honeycomb lattice description is also proposed in this paper, but the two descriptions are different. And later in these two papers, they also realized the wave function looks like this fringed spinner. So what physical consequences do we have based on such a picture? The first consequence is the interaction that we will add to the model will be different from the conventional on-set Hubbard interaction. Instead, the dominant interaction is this cluster charging interaction. This interaction is a summation over many terms, with each one defined on a hexagon. Each hexagon contributes to the energy amount that is proportional to the square of the charge surrounding the hexagon. Because all the sides, because of this shape of wave function, the charge in the middle is contributed from all the sides. And the chemical potential is such that at the experimentally relevant filling, on each hexagon there are on average 6 electrons. So finally the interaction looks like this. Because of this interaction, the dominant interaction is at the center of the hexagon instead of on the sides. So it's possible to have an on-set S-wave superconductor, which is usually not possible with strong repulsive interaction. Okay, I think the last slide is interesting. Here is the much more interesting part. So previously I said to match the representations at high symmetry points, I need to use a honeycomb lattice description. And based on that, I have some consequences. But just being able to match the representations doesn't mean I'm able to reproduce the band structure. To really be able to reproduce the band structure, I really have to find the localized Wallin functions and the redundant tight binding model. So let's ask, do localized Wallin functions really exist for such a band structure? The answer is no, if we want to implement all symmetries in a natural way. This is what we call the one-layer obstruction. We cannot write one-layer functions if all the symmetries are acted on-site. To understand such a one-layer obstruction, we need to use three ingredients. First, for each valley, each spin, there are two bands. Second, the system has a C2T symmetry. Third, there's the so-called non-zero net chirality of each valley, and I will explain what it means later. So from one, we know I can expand the Hamiltonian in terms of the Pauli matrices because it's a two-band system. From two, I know due to the symmetry, one of the Pauli matrices is eliminated. Let's say sigma z is forbidden. Then I can expand the Hamiltonian in terms of sigma x and sigma y. This gives me a two-dimensional vector, H1 and H2. The winding of this two-dimensional vector is what we call the chirality. To have any winding of such a two-dimensional vector, we know there must be some vortices. To have a vortex, it means the two bands touch. So only the band crossing points will contribute chirality. In this band structure, there are two band crossing points. That's the two Dirac crossing points. If we can write down a tight binding model that gives rise to this band structure, then there will be some problem because a tight binding model will automatically have zero net chirality across the entire Brillouin zone. This is simply a property of the periodicity of the Brillouin zone. However, in 2011, it's already known the chiralities of the single valley band structure of twisted valley graphene are the two Dirac crossings are the same. That is to say the total chirality of the entire Brillouin zone will also be non-zero. This is in sharp contrast to the case of a tight binding model such like in the ordinary graphene, we have two Dirac crossings. Each one has a non-zero chirality, but they are related by time reversal. Their chiralities are opposite. The total chirality is zero. Here, the total chirality is non-zero. So we will not be able to write any tight binding model. I can also explain this one-layer obstruction in another language. This language may indulge the SPT experts. Because the two Dirac crossings have the same chirality, I can write down a low energy effective Hamiltonian near the Dirac points. In this way, where Psi is the Dirac operator, the two-component Dirac operator. this Hamiltonian is actually problematic, because if I have the ingredients 1, 2, 3 in the last slide, the Hamiltonian will also unavoidably have another symmetry that is an anti-unitary symmetry that takes psi to sigma z times psi dagger transpose. Then you may recognize this Hamiltonian together with this symmetry implementation is precisely the anomalous to Dirac-Kohn surface state of a topological superconductor in class A3. Because it's a surface of some topological superconductor, we know we cannot write down any localized 1L function. This is another way to understand this 1L obstruction. By the way, there's actually another 1L obstruction of the band structure that I didn't mention at all in this talk. These two 1L obstructions are interrelated, and more details can be found in this paper.
So the fidget spinner state, you would not call it a localized function because it extends over basically 3 unit cells?
That's not the reason.
No, but I mean, you find in the end some wave functions, right?
And not yet.
The fidget spinners? Are those?
That's based on the assumption that the wave functions do exist.
Okay, but they're wrong, you say.
When we look more closely, we will see due to the 1L obstruction, they cannot exist.
Okay.
So life is hard.
Yeah.
Life is hard, but we still want to make progress. Let's make some progress.
Could include K electrons from K prime.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly how we proceed. So in the last two slides, I was saying there's a 1L obstruction, which means to have all the symmetries, U1 valley, C3, and C2T, to have all these symmetries implemented in an on-set fashion, I will not be able to write down the tight binding model and no 1L function. So to proceed, let's just ignore the U1 valley symmetry. This is equivalent to what Sansik just said by mixing the two valleys. Let's ignore the U1 valley symmetry. Then we will be able to write down a tight binding model and 1L functions. More precisely, here, in order to have 8 electrons per unit cell, including 2 spins, I should have 2 orbitals per site for each spin. The symmetry transformation properties of such 2 orbitals is such that under this, C3 is S-wave-like, meaning it doesn't have angular momentum. And under time reversal, there are time reversal singlets. After this, the fidget spinner wave function, as well as the cluster charging energy and everything, then follow. But the disadvantage here is the U1 valley symmetry is gone. But it is a symmetry of the, at least the emergent symmetry, good emergent symmetry of the system. It's a real thing with real consequences. So it would be better to have some way to restore the U1 valley symmetry. Now let me show you the result of our tight binding model. First, this figure is the original band structure. Eventually, our tight binding model wants to have the same dispersion as this one. Now let's look at the first 4 figures. They are the tight binding model constructed in the method from the last slide. That is, we ignore the U1 valley symmetry, write down the tight 1L function, and construct tight binding model. Here we have a parameter called TC. TC is the smallest hopping parameter in the system that we keep. As you can guess, if TC is very large, our dispersion will be very different from the original dispersion. But when we decrease TC, that is to say to increase longer and longer range interaction hopping, our dispersion will be closer and closer to this original dispersion. And indeed, this is the case. When we decrease TC, the dispersion looks closer and closer as the original dispersion. But you see there's a big deficiency. That is, the Dirac crossing at the K point is gone. This is also naturally expected because we don't have the symmetry to protect it. And what we can do is to restore the U1 valley symmetry. How do we do this? To do this, let's call the tight binding model Hamiltonian H from the first row. Let's call it H. Then to restore the U1 valley symmetry, we can first find the projector of the U1 charge. We find the projector and projects onto the subspace with a definite U1 charge, which we call P. Then we apply the projector to the Hamiltonian. This will throw away all the terms that breaks the U1 value symmetry and only keep the terms that doesn't break the U1 value symmetry. In such a way, the U1 value symmetry is back. And let's see what happens if we do a projection. This one, this dispersion looks very different as this dispersion. After this projection, immediately, the symmetry-related feature is already back. We have the dual crossing. And when we further decrease PC, it looks closer and closer to the original band structure. So this method works. And let me also mention, now I'm saying the method is working at the non-interacting level. But even if we include interaction, we can still apply the projection to get a fully interacting U1 value symmetric Hamiltonian.
So is the projected Hamiltonian local?
Huh?
Is the projected Hamiltonian local?
It says non-local.
Oh, okay. But the Hamiltonian is non-local.
The Hamiltonian is local.
After projection, is it? So projector you said is non-local.
Yes.
After you apply P left and right,
it's still
the Hamiltonian is still local. Or?
The Hamiltonian, the hopping still decreases exponentially.
So still local.
Yeah, but P itself is non-local. This is also consistent with what we said before. If we want to have localized, we cannot have localized value functions if we want to implement all symmetries on the in an on-set fashion. But if we give this up, if we allow the symmetries to be implemented in some non-local fashion, then we can have one-way functions.
At the expense of exponential k.
Yeah. This is actually the same when people studied the one-way functions of topological insulator. People also did this explicitly. That is, for a topological insulator, you cannot have one-way functions if you want to have time reversal symmetry implemented in an on-set fashion. But if you allow time reversal symmetry to mix different sites, that is to let it act on some offset fashion, then you will have tight binding model and one-way functions.
What determines the length scale for the exponential
tail? That's the detailed dispersion, I think. That's the detailed dispersion.
So can you, is that something that you can tune to make it small?
Yes.
If so, then somehow it seems to suggest that you could have done the same thing for based on the local orbital in the beginning.
But the local orbitals will not have on-set symmetry implementation. The Hamiltonian can still be written in terms of local orbitals. Just the symmetries have to move one orbital to the other, and actually to quite far away orbitals.
Which symmetry?
U1 value symmetry. You can also try to keep the U1 value symmetry and make other symmetry not acting on your own set fashion in principle.
Is the non-local only within this exponential tail?
Yes.
But if exponential tail becomes zero, that's the same as local.
Are you saying the non-local,
non-local
nature of the projector or of the Hamiltonian?
Hamiltonian. So
yeah.
You have projected Hamiltonian,
yeah,
which is still local.
Yes.
Up to exponential tail.
Yeah.
And you say the symmetry does not act locally,
yes,
to this new degree freedom.
Yes.
And I guess some local symmetry operation has some finite support, some support away from that location with some exponential tail.
This is the support of the symmetry action or of the Hamiltonian.
So when you apply local symmetry operation to say this rotated orbital operator in the projected Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
So when you add local rotation symmetry operation, how does it act?
It moves one orbital to the other orbital and to many other orbitals.
Many other orbitals.
Yeah.
And then you're saying that the way that other orbitals affected decays exponentially.
away from.
Kind of exponentially. But it, I think I misunderstood your first question. I thought you were asking whether the Hamiltonian can be make very, very localized.
Yeah.
That I can. And then?
You cannot?
I can.
You can.
Okay. Then the expense is I will make the P project not very local.
I see. P is always non
local. P is always non local. And if I want to make the Hamiltonian more local, although we didn't do, which I would think it doesn't decrease the locality of the P. One thing I want to say is actually the projector, I can also view the projector as a Hamiltonian. That Hamiltonian actually has the same obstruction as the original Hamiltonian.
So what is confusing is that the original Hamiltonian before projection included generic term.
Yes.
Generic local term.
Yes.
Then after projection, usually become non-local.
Right.
So are you saying only for some, because your original Hamiltonian had only special, maybe only working term, it remains local?
It's actually coming from the structure of the projector. The original Hamiltonian does include all the symmetry respected terms, but due to the some structure in the projector, it has eventually, when applied the projector, it doesn't become infinitely non-ranged.
Question is, suppose original Hamiltonian had some generic local term.
Yeah.
Interaction, short-term interaction, nearest neighbor, etc. And after projection, does the Hamiltonian remain local?
It does.
It does?
Yes. OK. So in this way, we can, in principle, have a symmetric full interacting model. But you can tell such a model would be very inconvenient and basically useless. And this is basically what I want to say in this talk. Let me summarize. I proposed to have the insulator, we should have the U1 valley symmetry breaking, but there should be some further effects. The goldstone from the U1 valley symmetry breaking couples to the electron that will promote the superconductivity. And we described an effective model on the honeycomb lattice to study the system. It has some features. It has one obstruction, but we can still have a tight bending model by hiding some of the symmetries, meaning making the symmetry actions non-local. Then we will have fixed spin wave functions and cluster charging energy. At the end, we can restore the symmetry by the projection method. This also works for many-body Hamiltonian. And there are many open problems. The most prominent one is whether we can have a better and a simpler model that is useful. After all, simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. Then we want to understand, in such a system, what are really the further effects that gives rise to the insulator? And we want to understand the nature of superconductivity and physics at other training. I think a very interesting potential future direction is using such a platform, what other interesting physics can be found. With this, I would like to thank you for your attention.
Questions? Maybe a bit of a heretic question. You spend a lot of time trying to get these Dirac cones on triangular lattice, basically. Is it really necessary to incorporate them in an effective model? Because the filling in which we're finding interesting experiments is in half fillings, so quite far away from the charge neutrality. So, do you think it might be possible to actually have a proper model of the diffusive bilayer insulated state that just ignores all this Dirac cone stuff?
Suppose this is possible. Then, in our mind, we also know if we want to have a model that is potentially able to describe all the filling factors, it's on a honeycomb lattice. Now, let's ask whether this model, whether the triangular lattice model can be used to maybe not at all the fillings, just at half the insulating filling. as I described in one of the slides, we need, if we just have valley symmetry breaking, even at the experimentally relevant filling factor for insulator, there will still be band crossing. That is to say, the band structure of the original band structure has the feature, has many features that, such that you want to preserve many of them. So that in the, even in the insulating filling factor, you still want to have keep, you still want to know there are dual crossings. They will cause some real physical consequences. Even just at this filling.
Is there an experimental signature of Dirac cone physics at the insulating filling that you can point to?
If I'm an infinitely powerful experimentalist with arbitrarily good students and a lot of funding, I can probe the symmetry breaking pattern of the system. If I indeed find there's not only valley symmetry breaking, but also other symmetry breaking, it would be consistent with the story I just told. But this is suggestive, it's not really a proof. But you know, experimentally, to really prove the experiments can disprove something, but to prove something is harder.
So it feels that this procedural projecting to the very limited preserved sector corresponds to some fine tuning, right?
It corresponds to throwing away some terms. It's tuning some the coefficients of some terms from finite to zero. It's not tuning it to 1, 2, 3, that kind of finite.
You do not tune to some zero, but to some particular values.
I do not tune to particular values. I tune them to zero.
But anyway, the projecting your Hamiltonian is from the point of view of tuning the parameters of your Hamiltonian. It's kind of fine. Can be viewed as a fine tuning.
Let's say there are different levels of fine tuning. Having a symmetry is also kind of a fine tuning.
Yeah, but in this case, it's not a microscopic symmetry.
It's not a microscopic symmetry, but I would say the level of fine-tuning by applying the projector is the same level of fine-tuning by having a symmetry.
You mean you're requiring symmetry?
Yes. There's a systematic way, as long as you give me the symmetry, there's the systematic way to obtain the final Hamiltonian. So in this sense, I would say is the level of fine-tuning is at the same level of having a symmetry instead of the more fine-tuning case.
Yeah, so you're saying this valley symmetry is not a microscopic symmetry, but for some reason, this symmetry is a very good approximate symmetry. So we don't know why it is approximately good symmetry, but
we kind of know why. Because the two valleys are far separated. To scatter from one valley to the other, it requires a high order process.
But is there a limit where it is exact?
Sorry, is there what?
A limit where it is exact?
In the limit where theta is zero, is exact. But this limit itself is kind of singular. So in the limit where theta goes to 0 plus, it's exact.
But even for generic interacting models, it's never a microscopic symmetry even for theta goes 0.
That's why I said theta equal to zero is actually singular. With the non-zero but small theta, it becomes better and better. When theta is really zero, so that the two layers are perfectly overlaid, it's actually different.
guys can discuss later. So that's the end of this paper.
Thanks.